Okay, in our study of Deuteronomy last week, we covered most of chapter 16, and I'd like to pick up in chapter 16 of Deuteronomy, beginning at verse 18. I noted last week that the last part of 16 really belongs with chapter 17, so I'm going to read the last part of 16 and then all of 17. So Deuteronomy 16, beginning at verse 18. You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not plant for yourself any tree as a wooden image near the altar which you build for yourself to the Lord your God. You shall not set up a sacred pillar which the Lord your God hates. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or sheep which has any blemish or defect, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. If there is found among you within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God in transgressing his covenant, who has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it is told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently. And if indeed it is true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has committed that wicked thing, and shall stone to death that man or woman with stones. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. So you shall put away the evil from among you. If a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge, between degrees of guilt for bloodshed, between one judgment or another, or between one punishment or another, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall all arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. And you shall come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge there in those days, and inquire of them. They shall pronounce upon you the sentence of judgment. You shall do according to the sentence which they pronounce upon you in that place which the Lord chooses. And you shall be careful to do according to all that they order you, according to the sentence of the law which they instruct you, according to the judgment which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left from the sentence which they pronounce upon you. Now, the man who acts presumptuously and will not heed the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judge, that man shall die. So you shall put away the evil from Israel, and all the people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children, in the midst of Israel. So in our study of Deuteronomy, especially beginning in chapter 12, I've noted that some commentators have observed a pattern, which is that the laws in Deuteronomy in this middle section of the book seem to be ordered according to the Ten Commandments. And we've taken a somewhat skeptical view of that, willing to see whether that works out or not. And I think it's been fairly clear over the last couple of chapters that the fourth commandment has been prominent in terms of the sabbatical year as an elaboration on the fourth commandment, and in the last chapter, the reference to the annual feasts, which seem to be built again on the sabbatical principle. So then the next topic would be the fifth commandment, and that does seem to fit here in the sense that the verses I just read especially have to do with authority, those exercising authority and those who have to respond to authority. Now that understanding of the fifth commandment you can see spelled out in great detail in the larger catechism, which has, I think, more questions on that commandment than any other, partly because of the controversies and disruption in their own times in the 1640s. But maybe just to help you think through that idea, I could think about the experience of a young person, say, growing up in our congregation. So you're used to being under authority, but suddenly, you know, you switch from the kid who has to stand in line at VBS to the one who has to tell the kids to stand in line at VBS. And maybe at that point or some other point, you start to say to yourself, this is what my parents went through when I didn't want to stand in line, or when I didn't want to clean my room, or whatever. And maybe you have younger siblings and it came up a lot earlier in your mind that this sort of thing is the case. And the point I'm making is that the basic family structure of the authority of parents and the responsibility of children to obey them, which is what we think of in the fifth commandment, right, honor your father and your mother, is really there as an example of the way we relate to authority generally. And it's pretty easy for us to understand that, as I said, even growing up in the relationships we have. And I think that's a good explanation or a good thing to think about as we think about these chapters. They don't talk about parents, right? These are about judges in the first part, and then kings in the second part. And actually, in the next chapter, it talks about the authority of the priests. And so the topics may not look like they fit in with the fifth commandment, but conceptually they do. They have to do with the way we relate to authority, both those who exercise authority and those who are under authority, and how they respond to it. Now, I want to split up the discussion into those two offices. First, the responsibilities of judges and the response of those under their authority. So that takes us from the last part of chapter 16 through verse 13 of chapter 17. And then there's a fairly clear break at verse 14 of chapter 17. He starts talking about the king and his exercise of authority. So let's think then about the way judges are to exercise authority. It says in verse 18, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, and they shall judge the people with just judgment." Now, this exercise of authority and the appointing of officers to judge is something that's already come up in Deuteronomy. It was actually in the first chapter, and that was really a review of what happened under Moses. Remember, Moses' father-in-law saw Moses wearing himself out, judging all the people, and gave him the good advice that he should appoint lesser judges, we would say, those who have ability to deal with less difficult cases, and the difficult cases would come to Moses. Well, now in Deuteronomy, we're on the border of the Promised Land. There's not going to be a Moses around anymore. So what is set up here is instead local courts. And that's actually one admirable aspect of this. They didn't have to go to this central place of worship to get justice. There were people who knew them and knew their situation, and they could go, as it says here, to the cities or to the gates to get justice. So that's a good thing. And as we'll go through the passage, we'll see there is a way of dealing with the more difficult cases. But that's one change that we've seen elsewhere in Deuteronomy, from the wandering in the wilderness with Moses leading them to a more settled condition in Canaan. Now, this passage gives some very general commands about the nature of judges. So they're supposed to be just. Okay, so one would hope so, but it says in verse 18 they should judge the people with just judgment. They're actually supposed to be appointed, apparently, by the people, and maybe through the people's representatives. And verse 19 talks about the way they shouldn't show partiality. They shouldn't take bribes. The poor would especially be disadvantaged in a bribe-taking situation because they couldn't compete monetarily with the rich. And there are other aspects that are brought out here. Some are not brought out as clearly here as they are in parallel passages. So in particular in Deuteronomy 1, the passage I referred to, and in 2 Chronicles 19, Lord willing, we'll look at that, where Jehoshaphat sought to revive the judicial structure that had fallen into disrepair, I guess. The judges are told they're supposed to rule according to God's law, which makes sense, that God is the source of right and wrong. God is the one who declares his law to us, and the judges use that as their standard. But also is a significant fact that the judges are the Lord's representatives. So God is the ultimate judge, but he gives men authority to judge. And that, on the one side, gives them a certain respect in the eyes of the people because they're standing in the place of God. But on the other side, if they are really ruling for God, then they should be like God, who shows no partiality, who doesn't take a bribe, and so on and so on. So it's a very high description of the office of judge, which is given here and elsewhere, and a call to act in justice. Now, the Hebrew mindset tends to be more concrete than abstract. And so what follows in verses 2 through 7 is a concrete example of how the judges are supposed to operate. I'm skipping a couple of verses there. I'll come back to them. They look like they don't really fit in, and we'll see whether they do or not. But instead of talking in generalities about the way judicial procedure should go forth, the Lord, through Moses here, gives a specific example. And as I said, it's in verses 2 through 7. And the specific example is a capital offense. And here the capital offense is apostasy. So apostasy of those who turn away from worshiping God to serve idols. And here specifically it's mentioned as the sun and the moon or any of the host of heaven, which was you may not be tempted to do that, but that was a common temptation, especially among the pagans who surrounded them. So you should look at verses 2 through 7 as giving a specific commandment. We saw before that apostasy was a capital offense for those who incited it, those who turned astray, and then, and this is in chapter 13, turned away from God and then sought to provoke others to turn away from God. But here it's talking about apostasy in the sense of anyone who turns away from God. And we saw before that in the system of the nation of Israel, that was really treason. Most nations treat treason as a capital offense, and so in that sense it's easier to understand why this is treated as a capital offense here. God was the covenant God, and they were rebelling against their king, and therefore should be put to death. So instead of focusing on apostasy as a capital offense, I want us to see what I think the purpose of this passage in chapter 17 is, which is to teach us about judicial procedure generally. Okay, again, in a concrete setting, some of us, especially mathematicians, may tend to, you know, prefer abstract principles, and every once in a while we give an example or something, which we call applications, but engineers wouldn't recognize as applications. But here is a very concrete situation from which we are expected to learn things more generally. So let's think about what they are. Well, first of all, is the significance of God and the fact that judges are there to rule in God's name, and therefore they must make the hard decision to carry out capital punishment. We think of them sometimes when we see a law like this as bloodthirsty people, they love throwing stones. Well, I don't think anyone would have said, oh boy, I get to execute an idolater today. But there is a commandment here that they are to rule according to God's law and therefore do it. But on the other hand, there is a danger that they would be hasty or zealous in a matter that is as significant as a capital offense. And so most of the passage is actually giving restrictions and cautions about the way they should act. There are safeguards in terms of the rules of evidence and the procedures that should be followed. And you'll notice as you read through this that really is the part that seems to be brought out. So, for example, verse 4, they are to inquire diligently. You know, not, oh, I heard he was an idolater, let's string him up. But no, they are to inquire diligently. And then verse 6 is a reference to two or three witnesses. And that's there specifically to prevent trumped-up charges And this reference, by the way, to two or three witnesses, this is the first time, as far as I can tell, there's a reference in Numbers 35, then here, and then I put up some others on the board. Actually, three in the Old Testament and three in the New Testament, references to the need for two or three witnesses. Again, that's a protection. So in terms of the conviction of an individual, especially in a capital case, it would be important to have not one word against another, he said, she said sort of thing, but that it would be two or three witnesses who would testify. And then also, we don't particularly like to think about this, but in verse 7, the way the execution took place, by stoning, the hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death. I think I mentioned before, people of my age read the lottery in high school, so when we think of stonings, we think of like completely arbitrary sort of thing. If you haven't read it, don't read it. It's not going to make that much difference to you. But the reason here why the witnesses are supposed to throw the first stone is probably because the witnesses are saying, his blood be on my head if I perjured myself. So it is intended to be a prevention, something to prevent perjury, that the witness would be the first one to cast the stone. And the consent of the people, in terms of the hands of all the people participating in the stoning, is no doubt there, because this is supposed to be a recognized judicial verdict. That is, one that is received the approval of the people in terms of being a just judgment. So even though we don't execute people by stoning, it is still valuable to understand from verse 7 what the point of that means of execution was. And there's given there in verse 7, so you shall put the evil away from you. Again, a confirmation that for the good of the nation, this sort of treason needs to be dealt with. Now, the next part then, I'm trying to go, trying to split the two parts evenly between the judges and the kings. So let's just look then quickly at the next part about the judges, which is verses 8 through 13. Now, this has to do with what you could call a system of graded courts. At least there are the local courts, and then there is a highest court. And as I said, this is similar to what was set up under Moses. But here it says in verse 8 at the last part, you shall rise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So we've seen that reference before, right? The central place of worship, which ultimately was Jerusalem, where the temple was built under Solomon. And this would also be the place where they would take the difficult cases. It's not really said here that these are courts of appeal in the way we would think of them, but they are supreme courts, and the emphasis on the supremacy is pretty clear in the verses that follow. But it is still a provision that if in a local setting the decision is difficult, perhaps the judge is too close to the parties, here's a provision for what we call a change of venue, where they could go to another location, and especially if the judgment is simply too difficult for the local judges to handle. So this is, again, a good part. It's easy to see why this would be a helpful thing. If a person feels he can't get justice, or if the local judges are subpar, there is the opportunity to go to higher courts to find a resolution of the situation. Now, that... So I said the passage especially emphasizes the response of the people to the justice that's rendered, verses 10 through 13. Probably it's especially emphasizing the response to the judgment rendered at the highest level, but it would apply to all of the results of judgment, which is, you shall be careful to do according to all that they order you. Okay? No. You know, we don't always like the decisions of our Supreme Court, and we probably have lots of things to complain about at the local level, too. But the passage emphasizes that they should listen to the sentence, and in fact, there's a reference here even to the instruction. The part of the priests and the Levites in this system would especially be helpful because they could explain God's law in connection with the verdict. But the passage emphasizes that they should not turn aside to the right hand or to the left from the sentence. They should submit themselves to the judgment. And even in verse 12, the rebellion against that sentence can lead to death. The person who acts presumptuously that man shall die. And there's a benefit for all of society. And again, I think it's something that's pretty easy to understand. If people just went around disregarding the verdicts of courts, you would have anarchy. The court would have no authority. And so it says in verse 13, all the people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. Now, let me just add a footnote that the assumption in all this is that the judges are ruling according to God's law. We can all think of cases where submission, well, to use a New Testament phrase, submission in the Lord is an important qualification. But this is not dealing with details like this. This is simply setting forth the general aspects of justice, which is for the good of society, men should set aside their grumbling and submit to the decision of the court. As it happened, of course, especially at the time of the Reformation, there were difficult cases where it was felt that men had to question the rule of the king or whoever is in authority. It's interesting that Calvin in his sermons, not in his commentary, but in his sermons, so to his congregation, specifically raises this question. Well, what if what the judge does isn't in accordance with God's law? And he simply notes the point that the assumption here is that men shall rule according to God's law. Elsewhere, for example, in the Institutes, he sets forth the lesser magistrates as a means of recourse. If the supreme leader is acting unjustly, men, the people do have rights to question, but they should act as far as possible within the order and seek the help of lesser magistrates. So that's not really the point of the passage here, but I don't want to sound like the Bible teaches like absolute submission to rulers. After all, it's one of our guys who wrote Lex Rex, Samuel Rutherford, The Law and the King, arguing that the king is supposed to submit to the law, not that the king is the law. And this is, you might say, a primer that we're seeing here, that sort of the first principles of how judges are to rule and how we are to respond to them. Now, I skipped over a couple of verses. You may have noticed, actually, I guess three verses, two at the end of chapter 16 and one at the beginning of chapter 17. So if you're following along and wondering why those verses have anything to do with the fifth commandment or even the topic at hand, well, I'll concede that maybe they don't. I'll give you an explanation that I read that may or may not be helpful. The references in verses 21 and 22 are to the local pagan worship, which they would have found when they went to Canaan. And we saw references to this before. The trees, the images, the pillars, and so on. Well, apparently these places were not only places for worship in the strict sense, but they were also consulted as oracles. Okay, we think of Delphi and the Greeks and all those guys. But this is apparently a practice then, so that when they went to these places, they could seek judicial verdicts from the sacred pillar. You know, who the man behind the curtain was, I don't know, but that was the apparently part of the practice there. And so verses 21 and 22 would therefore say, don't resort to pagan authorities and to demonic forces, but instead look to God as your authority and to the judges he has appointed. That seems like a reasonable argument. Chapter 17, verse 1, it brings up another topic, one that we've seen already in Deuteronomy, which is not giving God the worst animal you can think of from your flock or herd. Okay, and that, I think, as I mentioned before, has to do with the fact that God deserves respect. In fact, in Malachi makes exactly that comparison. He says, well, try giving that to your governor. See what he would think about this, you know, weird-looking lamb or whatever. So this is possibly fitting in with the same idea that God is the ultimate authority, and one way of submission, expressing submission to that authority is to not give him a defective animal in the sacrifice. Or maybe not. So I'm not going to press the point that every verse has to fit in with the theme, but I think the theme of authority overall is fairly clear. So I'd like to think a little bit about applications of this first part of chapter 17, and then we'll look at Kings and then think a little bit more about that. And the most important thing from the point of view of our understanding of God's rule over the world and what is communicated here is that civil government and the exercise of justice are a gift of God. Okay? Now, you know, we're not always happy with what happens in the government, and we may be upset by different rulings, but we should realize that God is the one who has set up the system. As Paul says in Romans 13:1, the powers that be are ordained of God. And even when sinful men rule, they are in some sense representatives of God, however we may view their authority in light of their relationship to God's law. So that's probably a very important thing for us to hear, and a difficult thing for us to hear. Let me move on then to apply some of the principles. The reference to the two or three witnesses I already noted appears again and again in the New Testament, and especially in the context of what we would call church discipline. So Matthew 18:16, Jesus is talking about the brother and the need to resolve the dispute between the brother, and after individual attempts at reconciliation have failed, you can take it to others, but there is a need for two or three witnesses. The sort of rules of evidence that were specified here in Deuteronomy and earlier in Numbers are repeated in the New Testament, as I said, at least a couple of other times. Especially 1 Timothy 5:19 has to do with charges against elders. So the basic principles are applied in the New Testament, even in not in a civil setting, but in a ceremonial setting. Second of all, let me just mention briefly that Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, when he is dealing with feuds among the Corinthians, and some of them were taking others to court, you remember that, he's probably alluding to this passage and has in mind the system of judges. He says, you know, aren't there any judges among you? Isn't there someone who's capable of rendering judgment? And he probably has in mind this system of the Old Testament where in the local setting there would be those who were able to judge. Thinking, though, of how this points to Christ, we should probably first of all remember that Jesus suffered perhaps the greatest failure of justice in human history. Okay, so if we think of unjust rulers and the contrast with the way things are supposed to be in Deuteronomy 17, think of the way Jesus' trial was run, how they brought together witnesses who couldn't agree with each other, and how they condemned him anyway when they had some trumped-up charge they could find in common. So Jesus understands and suffered under bad judicial rule, wicked judicial rule. And it's a reminder for us, first of all, that we, insofar as we are required to suffer, should identify with him in that. And we should be comforted that he is the ultimate judge. I put up only three references, John 5, Acts 17, and 2 Timothy 4, but repeatedly the New Testament says he is coming to judge. This one who was God and man, God has the right to judge in himself, but it's especially emphasized that the mediatorial judge, Jesus, will be the one who judges at the end of time. The Father has appointed him particularly to judge men because he himself has a human nature. And therefore, we should honor him chiefly, whatever our view about civil government is and our response to submit to it. We should remember that in all injustices and justices alike, Jesus is the ultimate king. Let me just add a technical footnote before I give you a chance to say anything. There's a little bit of confusion here in terms of what exactly the role of the priests is. Are these church courts or are these civil courts? And the distinction may not, that we make may not exactly correspond to what was going on in Deuteronomy, but If you'll turn with me quickly to 2 Chronicles 19, I'll just point you to a passage you might think about more later on. 2 Chronicles 19 I mentioned earlier because Jehoshaphat was a king who sought to reform the judicial system in his time, so one of the later kings of the southern kingdom. And you can read the whole passage beginning at verse 4, but notice specifically in verse 11 of 2 Chronicles 19. I'll just read that one verse. He says, "And take notice, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites will be officials before you. Behave courageously, and the Lord will be with the good." So he seems there to be thinking of this highest court that we talked about, which would have been centered in Jerusalem at this time. And he seems to be distinguishing between the ruler in the church, if you want to call it that, the chief priest who is over them in the matters of the Lord, and the civil ruler who is over them Zebediah, for all the king's matters. So at the time of the Reformation, especially George Gillespie argued that there was some distinction between the civil authority and the church authority. That was important in his time because of arguments about what's called Erastianism, the state trying to impose itself on the church. So it's I would just say, if you want to investigate that question further, don't just read Deuteronomy 17, but also read 2 Chronicles 19, which seems to highlight a certain distinction which isn't as clear in Deuteronomy. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit more about our response to authority after we look at the king. But any questions so far about judges? Yes, Vicki.
A couple of things. It's interesting that our Western law is obviously based on this teaching, so it's hard to understand. Well, it's not hard to understand. We just don't remember that connection. That's why people are so offended by the Ten Commandments being in the courtroom.
Right. Right.
And the second thing about justice, seems a little technical to me sometimes and dry, but when you think about it as reestablishing God's order or the making of things right, reestablishing right. That goodness and holiness becomes more personal and real.
That's very good. Yeah, that's right. And that, I think that, that would really communicate to the people because they understood that God was their king, he was good to them, and the treasonous act of idolatry in this case would disturb the whole society. And so this is in place to provide for them. We tend to focus on stoning. It's pretty grim. But, yeah. Is that?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I was just trying to understand the Levites in this situation.
Yeah.
Being it, I'm trying to think, like Geneva with Calvin and stuff. It was like take the trials from Medus or something.
Right.
It wasn't Calvin actually passing judgment on him, but he was used as.
He consulted,
right.
The civil authorities.
He was sort of the word, the word of God. He was the one that brought the charge from the word. So is that kind of?
I would say that would be a faithful implementation of this, because the civil magistrate is supposed to himself be a student of the word of God, and that's actually in the next part of the chapter. But it makes sense for the one who teaches the law, which is what's referred to here, is being. What we would call a consultative member of the court. He could address it.
Right.
Yeah. And just to clarify, John knows this, but Calvin did not want Servetus executed the way he was executed. It wasn't like he got his way in what he wanted. He wasn't the guy who pulled all the strings in Geneva. But it was a civil execution. If you don't know who Servetus was, ask John afterwards. Any other questions? I'm sorry? Okay. Well, let's look then briefly at the last part of the chapter. Verses 14 through 20 talk about the king. Now, this is looking into the distant future. Okay, God had appointed a system, namely Moses, as the ruler in the wanderings in the wilderness, and for some time afterward there would be Joshua, and then there would be judges in the, so actually probably more in the sense of kings than in the sense of rendering authority. They had both responsibilities. But when the people tired of that in the time of Samuel, they asked for a king. And this is looking forward to that time. This is in anticipation of that request. And since I mentioned Samuel, you may notice that it says, they will say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. Twice in 1 Samuel 8, the people use exactly that phrase. We want a king like all the nations around us. Okay? It's not a good motivation, okay? But that's the prophecy here that is expected that will happen. Maybe if I come to it and if I think of it, I'll try to explain a little bit about how that fits in with, you know, God's, you know, that was a rebellious act in Samuel's time, but here God is setting out rules for it, and it also ties into the way the king was a type of Christ. But let's here especially focus just on the regulations given for the king here. So first, there are several qualifications that are given. Okay, and the king is, first of all, to be the one, in verse 15, whom the Lord your God chooses. In Hosea, it says, they appointed kings, but not by me. Okay, so this was something that they didn't observe, but it was supposed to be a person appointed by God. And secondly, it was supposed to be a native. One of your brethren should be appointed as a king. Now, just to comment on that briefly, probably the principal thing that would come to mind and what they would first understand from that is that the one who would rule over them should be from among them because he was a member of the covenant community. He would understand God's laws, and he would understand their culture, I guess we would say. It wouldn't make sense to bring in a pagan king to rule over them. When that happened later on, like when Athaliah, you know, who was the daughter of a pagan queen from the northern kingdom, she tried to wipe out the royal line, so that wasn't a good result. It makes sense then that the one who would rule over them should be from among them, a member of the covenant community, and their brother, as it was a homogeneous covenant community at that time in terms of the ethnic background. Also, this person being your brother points forward to Christ as the ultimate king. Christ was not simply God, but God and man. So the one who rules over us is one who understands our nature, who is our brother in that sense. And I think it's a helpful thing to keep in mind as you think of that requirement. So that's the basic qualification then. And then there are restrictions on the behaviors of the king. And the three restrictions that are given, you know, first of all, he's not supposed to multiply horses. Bridget, don't take it too literally. It's okay to have horses and like them and all that. But he's not supposed to multiply horses. He's not supposed to multiply wives, which I think we can understand. And he's also not supposed to multiply gold and silver for himself. And, okay, you know, we kind of wonder why those three. Those would probably be emblematic of the way the other kings acted in the nations around them. In the ancient Near East, this was the way you showed you were hot stuff, or whatever the phrase they would have used. And that was that you had a large army. The horses would represent military power. You had a harem, and harem isn't actually the right word. The reason you would want to multiply wives is partly for political alliances. Okay, so this was a way of tying in with other nations, and therefore lifting your own esteem among other nations. And then thirdly, the multiplying silver and gold probably has to do with the fact that you centralize government and you've got a lot of taxes. Now, don't jump to conclusions here, okay? But that's probably the way they would show their power, and it would be with a large treasury, which no doubt they didn't earn themselves, but they got from the people. But the kings are not supposed to act that way. And Klein, in his comment, points out very well that in the other nations, the king was a god. In Israel, God was the king. And so even when they had kings later on, the ultimate king was God himself. In fact, that's what God says to Samuel. They have rejected me as king, and therefore they want a king for themselves. So that's maybe a helpful way of thinking about these restrictions. There are other aspects that going to Egypt would especially be turning back to the bondage from which they had escaped. And the political alliances that marriage would bring would also bring temptations to idolatry, besides the fact that polygamy is contrary to the law of God in itself. So there are other aspects, but that's probably a helpful summary. Now, the passage emphasizes especially that the person should not be proud, and that comes in connection with his reading of God's law. But this tendency to puff yourself up, to build up your army and your alliances and your wealth, would go along with the idea of the king who thinks of himself as really supreme over the people. And it's striking that instead, in verse 20, it says, his heart should not be lifted above his brethren. You're king, but they're still your brothers. And that's a very helpful thing to remember. So then let's look at the third part of this, which is the very interesting requirement that the king is supposed to write out a copy of the law for himself. Now, there's a reference here to the book that the priests, the Levites, keep. And later on in Deuteronomy, it's said that the priests would keep a copy of the law. And that's probably has to do with the covenant structure that the God who makes the covenant, viewed as the great overlord, would keep so one tends to joke and say, carbon copy of the covenant. He would have the original, and the people would have a copy of it. But the presence with the priests would emphasize that at the very heart of their worship is the fact that God is the lawgiver and they belong to God. And later on in one of the revivals, the priests present the king with a copy of the law. I believe part of the coronation ceremony in the UK is that the queen in the 50s was presented with a copy of the Bible as we hope something that would be somewhat relevant to what she did as queen. But here is something interesting that's added to it. It's not simply that the king is given a copy of the law, but he's given it so that he can copy from it and write his own version of it. That doesn't sound right. It's not his own version, but write down for himself what's in the book. Now, maybe I should have said this first. It's not exactly clear what the law refers to. It could be that the law refers to the book of Deuteronomy or the central portion of it. It may be instead that it has to do especially with the law that was given at Sinai by Moses. So there's a important part of the book of Exodus where the law is spelled out as it was declared by Moses. In Deuteronomy, when it refers to the law, it usually looks back to the giving of the law at Sinai. In any case, it wasn't the whole Bible, okay, but it was a significant portion of it, and it was especially the law because he was supposed to understand the law. Now, there's some speculation about why this would be required beyond what's stated here. Is there a value in actually writing things down that would make it stick in your memory or cause you to meditate further on it? I don't know, but I thought I would mention that in recent years, Reformation Heritage Books has started publishing these things that they call journables. I think that's the way you pronounce it. I think that's journal with Bible. It makes me think of gerbils, but I don't think that's what I'm talking about. So journables. So they have journables for different books of the Bible. It's called the 17-18 series. I wonder why. Deuteronomy 17-18. And it's basically a mostly blank book where there are verse numbers, just numbers, and you write down the verse of the Bible that goes with that number. And on the other side, there are occasional questions for thought that you can try to answer. But it's mostly blank. I don't know. I haven't bought any of them. They have them on many books of the Bible, not just like Deuteronomy or Exodus. But I just thought I would mention that as kind of an interesting thing. It's a reference to Deuteronomy 17:18, so there you go. But here specifically, the result is supposed to be that it would be with him, verse 19, he shall read it all the days of his life, and that he would learn to fear the Lord his God and observe all the words of this law and these statutes. That's probably a good lesson for us in our reading of the Bible. Sometimes easy just to read it, but he's actually supposed to profit from it, supposed to think about it, and it's supposed to guide the way he rules. Okay, I know this is offensive in American society, but the king was actually supposed to be guided by God's law. It wasn't just his private devotions. This was the way he was supposed to rule in light of what the law said. And then verse 20 emphasizes this aspect that I've already brought out, that his heart would not be lifted above his brethren. And God promises a blessing here, just as he promised blessings earlier, specifically for the king, that he would have a dynasty, that he and his children would be prolonged in the days of their rule. Now, let me just briefly, we did start a little bit late, so I'm going to go a couple of more minutes, but let's think a little bit about the way this applies to us. We don't have kings anymore. I guess they do in some countries, but we don't. But at the very beginning of the class, I tried to draw you in by thinking about the way we make the transition from being under authority, we all have parents, to learning to exercise authority to some extent. Okay, maybe that you're the VBS leader and you got to tell the kids to stay in line. It may be that you're supposed to be the leader of this project in your class and you can't get the guys to show up for meetings. You know, there are all kinds of situations in which we are not exercising authority, at least intended to give some leadership. And this passage helps us to understand, the whole chapter actually helps us to understand that. And first of all, it helps us to understand that leadership is a privilege, it's a gift of God, and therefore we should turn away from pride. We should not puff ourselves up because we're the big dogs, or whatever the right phrase is, but instead, as it says in verse 20, even the king should not lift his heart above his brethren. If the king of Israel wasn't allowed to lift his heart above his brethren, how much more should we be willing to have humility even as we have authority? So that's on the one side for those who exercise authority, and on the other side it is for those who submit to authority to realize that God puts people in this position for a reason. It may be to teach us patience, but in any case we are to submit as to the Lord. Let me just make a couple of other comments and then we can take some questions and stop. This is an encouragement, especially the last part of the passage, for us to study God's Word. I already mentioned the value that the king was supposed to take from it. But, you know, kings were busy people. There were a lot of things going on, and yet God expects them to take time at the beginning of their reign to write out the law and read it all the days of his life. So it's a critical thing, whether you're a king, or whatever exercise of authority you have, or whatever authority you're under, to take God's law and to meditate on it and to let it guide you. I know it's not easy. I've had plenty of opportunities on both sides, both exercising authority and being under authority, to realize how difficult it could be. But God provides one way to help us, and that is the instruction in his word. And then let me just close by reminding you that Christ, of course, is the ultimate son of David. The whole kingship of line of the southern kingdom was no doubt permitted by God, put in place by God, to prefigure Christ, the ultimate king to come. And we should therefore look to him as our king. We shouldn't trust in princes. Even those who have given authority will fail, are given authority will fail us. We should trust in Christ the king and look to him to provide. And we should also look at the way he rules. And I'll close with this. I don't think we'll turn there. But Matthew 20, the disciples were squabbling over who would be first among them. Jesus is about to be crucified. And the main thing they can talk about is who's going to be first among them. So he says, you know, don't take your model the Gentile rulers. Take as your model me, because I came to be a servant, and I came to be a ransom for sinners. And so we should, in all of our rule, but especially in the church, that's the situation he has in mind there, especially in the exercise of authority in the church, we should realize that we are humble ministers of Christ, and we are not to lord it over others. Okay. Comments or questions on Deuteronomy 17, last part of 16? Yes?
There's also an application for parenting.
Yes. Yes, that's right. The same attitude of not seeking our own, which is really what it's saying about the king. Don't seek your own things. Seek the good of those under you. That's good. I mentioned the larger catechism. It really is a very helpful section of the larger catechism. It talks about the responsibilities of superiors and of inferiors. No one likes to think of themselves as inferior, but inferior in terms of being under authority. And then sins and responsibilities of equals also. It's a very helpful section and encourages us to think about these things.
And you might want to ask the CYers if they have any recollection of that, since that's exactly what we're studying.
Okay. I'd forgotten that.
28 for each.
I'd forgotten that. Good. Other comments? Okay. Let's close up.